If you reckon you're feeling a bit worse off these days, well, you are probably right. The evidence is in. Out today, one of the nation's largest household surveys, it's called this, Household Income and Labour Dynamics in Australia, or to give it its first name, HILDA. Its findings that fewer of us can afford to own homes. One in eight families have only $500 or less in savings. Real household disposable incomes peaked in 2009. Let's dig a bit deeper into HILDA. We've assembled a panel of interested experts. John Daly is CEO of the Grattan Institute. Ebony Bennett is Deputy Director of the Australia Institute. Welcome to you both. John, to you first. Times getting tougher?
They certainly seem to be, and that, I guess, fits with the mood of the electorate, that we've seen disposable income, so that's your income after tax, essentially tailing off or going flat from about 2009. And at the same time, one of the other things that comes through the survey is the way that the amount that households are spending on childcare has gone up very fast. So the amount that you've got really left over to spend on all of the things we'd like to spend money on is, if anything, probably decreasing over the last 5 years.
Ebony, if there's a sort of a subtext story to all this, it's a generational one, I think, between older and younger Australians, and a real difference in their circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely. So we can really see it come through quite clearly, I think, particularly when it comes to affordable housing. And we can see that there's been almost no decline in home ownership amongst older age groups, whereas, you know, home ownership has declined from 39% to 29% for people who are 25 to 34 years old. So you've got younger generations who are being excluded from the housing market. They're finding it harder to find full-time work with basic leave entitlements. There's been a lot more part-time and insecure work created in this economy. And so there is a greater divide now between the generations.
On the thing of home ownership, John, I mean, the HILDA estimates, they say as early as next year, fewer than half of adult Australians will own a home. I mean, this is a huge societal shift.
It is a big shift, and it's one that's been going on for a long time, and it's been hidden by the demographics. So it's looked as though the total percentage of the population with owning their own homes hasn't moved very much. But what that's concealed is that really since about 1980 onwards, for all the younger age groups, we've seen home ownership rates falling. And given that that started happening in 1980, we're now seeing home ownership rates falling even for 55-year-olds. And so, of course, finally it's showing up in the overall averages. But when you see less than half of 35 to 44-year-olds owning their own home, and of course, if you don't own your own home by the age of 44, chances are you're not going to be buying your first home aged 50.
Is that in and of itself, Ebony, a terrible thing? I mean, we can still have accommodation, we can rent, or is it a real disadvantage in a culture and a society that's geared around the idea of owning a home as your most significant asset?
Absolutely. And if you look at the HILDA data, property is one of the major portions of household wealth. So if you've got whole generations who are kind of missing out, what's going to happen when they're retiring and still have to rent and, you know, are drawing on those savings for that portion of their life? You know, it's one of the great bulwarks against poverty is owning your own home. And we've got, you know, now successive generations who are finding it increasingly difficult, and it doesn't look like it's going to change anytime soon. We've just had a federal election where, you know, the policy settings from the party that's won government aren't looking at changing any of the policy settings to really fix this problem of housing affordability. And we've got the average house who has two properties. Meanwhile, young people can't even get into the homeowner, you know, can't even buy their first home.
It's a really interesting thing, John Daly, from a policy point of view. I mean, we have a lot of rhetoric around cost of living, around home ownership. It's talked about constantly. And this situation we're describing here is not something which has developed overnight. And yet the policy responses to these things are utterly absent, despite its prominence in the sort of the public conversation.
Yeah, and even if I can afford to buy a house, I'm worried that my child can't afford to buy a house. That seems to be the real barbecue stopper at the moment. I think the reason we're making so little progress is that the two policy things that would make a real difference are two things that are politically incredibly hard. So the first thing that would make a difference is to look at planning legislation. By and large, that makes it very difficult to subdivide in the middle rings of our cities. Everybody agrees that we should allow more townhouses to be developed, but only in the suburb next to theirs. There is no area of public policy which is more politically for.
That's only if we ask the homeowners, of course.
Well, and of course we do, because the homeowners are the people who vote in local council elections. So that's the planning side. Yep. And, you know, I think one of the things to be very clear about is I'm not blaming the planners for this. I'm blaming electorates for this. This is what politicians do in response to the way that people vote. And then, of course, the other issue is our tax settings, particularly around negative gearing and capital gains tax. They make it very attractive to own investor property. By definition, every time a house, you know, becomes owned by an investor rather than a homeowner, you've got one less person owning their own home. So, changing those capital gains tax negative gearing rules is politically very fraught, although interestingly, I think this is changing. I don't think anyone is suggesting that the Labor Party actually lost votes in the last election for the policies that they took around changes there. And that makes me suspect maybe that one will change over the next couple of years.
We'll take that up with Shadow Treasurer Chris Bowen after the 7 o'clock news. But Ebony, I mean, do you agree with that? Those broad prescriptions that it's around tax and it's around planning?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd really concentrate on the interaction between negative gearing and the capital gains tax discount. It's really distorting the residential property market. And we can see, you know, the Australian Institute has done research that shows more than half of that benefit goes to the top 10% of income. Sorry, the top 10% of households by income. So it's really, even though it's politically fraught, the benefits are accruing to a very small proportion of the population.
You may have seen this reported today, HILDA, Household Income and Labour Dynamics in Australia. It's a fairly comprehensive bit of research. Chewing that over, John Daly from the Grattan Institute, Ebony Bennett from the Australia Institute. I mean, let's look at some gender issues here, which we've talked about age and housing affordability, but HILDA also exposes some really interesting difference between genders.
Yeah, we can see that overall men are still earning more, no surprises there. A couple of the things that I thought was interesting was they're getting slightly more sleep and slightly more exercise than the average woman, which, you know, I think we can see that women are still doing the lion's share of the housework and, you know, maybe they're up late at night and getting poor sleep because they're worried they're going to retire with half the average super balance of the average man. They're, you know, finding it hard to find secure work.
It's and financial stress that does it.
Exactly. It's a lot of financial stress, and women are more likely to be single parent households. And we can see that the poverty rates for single parent families showing about 1 in 5 of those types of families are in poverty. So there's plenty of reasons not to be able to sleep well if you're a woman.
HILDA certainly digs in deep to Australian culture. On poverty, John Daly, what does it mean for Australia if 1 in 8 families have $500 or less in savings?
Well, it means that they are very precarious. It means that you only need a small thing to go wrong, and then life becomes very difficult. And the other thing that we do get out of the HILDA survey is measures of poverty. And of course, there's two ways to think about poverty. Mm. One way is that you think about it as how many people have a percentage, often it's half, of the median income. So in other words, we judge poverty relative to, you know, what the rest of the community looks like. And on that measure, we've seen very little reduction in poverty. And that's not surprising. If you judge it as a percentage, then inherently it doesn't tend to move very much. We can also look at absolute poverty. So what's the, you know, literally the number of dollars you've got to play with in real terms. That's actually improved. I think one of the things that's not appreciated in a lot of Australia is we import America and assume that things that are happening in the US are happening here. And there's this claim that's often made that we've seen no improvement in the life circumstances of the bottom 20% over the last 15 years. As HILDA shows, that's just not true. We saw a very big jump in incomes for all households, including the bottom 20%, particularly between 2000 and 2010. The catch, of course, is that since 2009, 9, 10, we haven't seen much increase, if any at all, in incomes. And that's been true for the bottom 20% as it's been true for most other households.
Which leads to an interesting observation in Hilda Ebony about deprivation. 12% of Australians deprived of at least two essential items, 7% deprived of at least three. It's something that we should probably take more heed of.
Absolutely. And I think it's, linked to that concept that we were talking about before of the precariousness and not having even $500 in savings in the bank for emergencies. You know, if you do need to take your kid to the dentist, which is one of the measures that they've got here, you know, those types of things, if you can't afford them, then very quickly, you're going to run into trouble.
Well,
and
that's certainly quite an alarming thing on dentistry. I mean, young kids just not going to the dentist and showing up at the age of six or so in huge percentages with decay and just through lack of attention.
Yeah, it's very, very seriously linked to long-term health outcomes as well. And we can see other elements of, affordability of everyday life, like being able to afford new clothes for school-aged children. Mm, 7% of people surveyed said that they couldn't afford those. And, 60% think those things are essential. And I think most people would agree that those are the, essentials of everyday life.
And running under all of that, John Doty, that sense of precariousness, that's a really interesting idea.
It's a real problem. It's also, there's some very important patterns about which households are precarious. So we tend to think, the households that are precarious are the people on age pension. It's not true. Households that own their own home and are on the age pension, they're doing fine. Even households that don't own their own home but are on the age pension, they're not all of them doing particularly well, but their level of precariousness is not particularly high.
There's a certainty about their situation.
There's a certainty about their situation. The households that we have to be really worried about are the working age households who are not in work, so who are on welfare. Basically, people are on New Start. Their only income is disability support pension or whatever it might be. They show much, much higher levels of precariousness. That's no doubt a consequence of the way that New Start pays a lot less than the age pension. And of course, those two welfare rates have diverged a lot over the last 15 years. And so we do now have a set of households who are unemployed at the moment, and their lives are, by and large, they don't own their own homes. When they don't own their own homes, their lives are extremely precarious.
What are the big policy learnings from this, Ebony? I mean, what should government be thinking looking at this report?
Well, I was just listening to George Christensen just before talking about the superannuation changes. I mean, there you've got a system that is designed to help people save for their retirement, and the tax concessions that we have currently are making it cost more and more to the budget every year. And it's essentially become a tax minimisation scheme for the very wealthy. So, there aren't many people who are going to be able to afford to put an extra $500,000 in their superannuation over their lifetimes. And those are the types of things that we have to tackle in the next couple of parliaments and really look at this silly idea of needing to have a budget surplus and to cut back on things like New Start to pay for that. And we've got, that kind of rhetoric happening throughout the election and through budget cycles. But what it means is, people who rely on government spending and government services, they're missing out to pay for, tax breaks for the very, very wealthy.
Your sense, John Dale, I mean, as you said before around housing, some of the policy solutions here are tough politically.
They are tough, but as a proportion of the population that doesn't own a house rises,
they'll get easier.
Politically, it gets easier. And actually, superannuation is an interesting example of that. We've certainly had a government that's taken a series of superannuation changes to the election, contrary to some of the claims by some of the Conservative members of the Liberal Party. If anything, it appears to have won them votes in the places most affected. So I think that there is the potential for change, but as with any kind of policy change, there will be people who don't do so well out of it, and they will yell. And I think one of the problems we've got at the moment is everyone assumes as soon as anyone yells about a policy change, stop. If you look back at the 90s, this supposedly golden period of policy reform, there was plenty of yelling at the time. And if you're going to make policy reforms, then you have to argue the case, and then you have to be able to and prepared to stare down the vested interests. One of the things we can see from Hilda is there's not a lot of people with $1.6 million in savings. the idea, if you really do need $1.6 million in savings to have a comfortable retirement, there are going to be very, very few Australians with a comfortable retirement.
Well, at least we have some evidence. We can perhaps move on from that to some evidence-based policy. Who knows, in my world of dreams. Hilda, out today. John Daly is CEO of the Grattan Institute. Ebony Bennett is Deputy Director of the Australia Institute. And as I say, we'll hear some more on housing affordability with Shadow Treasurer Chris Bowen straight after the 7 o'clock news. Talking business and finance next. It's 7 away from 7 on RN Drive.